I will have to be careful what we say.
Is anyone else on WebEx? I can't find my... It's not working. And I can go out and go back in, but I just want to check if it's working for anybody else.
Yeah, I'm on. I see it.
Okay, all right. I'll try again. Thanks.
Okay, well, we probably should get started. I want to start by just updating everybody on the symposia. When we talked last, we were frantically planning, and we were able to address the issue of sharing how to access CFAST data with the help of Jeff Wozniak, who obtained a slot for that presentation on the fetal alcohol study group, which is really the best place for it because in that room is virtually anybody who would want to access our data. And it comes at a time when most of the fetal alcohol researchers are present, in contrast to at a symposium where people tend to be divided into run around the different symposia that have competing interest to them. So I think that's a good solution. We won't do it in Berlin because there aren't very many FAS researchers in Europe, and certainly not those who wouldn't have come to the FAS study group anyway. I sent around what was the submitted version of the RSA symposium, and for those who have had a chance to look at it, Johan, this is called Genes, Drugs, Money, and Vitamins, CFAST Studies of Risk and Resilience in FASD. And it really focuses on some of the factors that facilitate or mitigate the effects of alcohol during pregnancy. Johan is going to talk about his latest and greatest on various candidate genes. Scott Parnell is going to present the data that you've been hearing about regarding the synergistic effects of synthetic cannabinoids and alcohol in a mouse model. Jeff is going to present data that looks at the role of socioeconomic status in brain development in the CFAST population with some interesting findings. And Tina is going to talk about factors of risk and resilience related to social, lifestyle, and nutritional factors based on the Ukraine cohort. And they have to accept this, but I'm excited about this symposium. And there's been some discussion of particularly looking at the human data and the role of socioeconomic status on not only brain imaging, but also on neurocognitive function as a potential paper. Again, we're really encouraging cross-modality papers because they will speak best to what CFAST was established to do. And I know there's been some back-channel discussion about this, but these are the kinds of papers that we would want to look to. Again, the data that I saw from what Elizabeth and Jeff and others put together very quickly looked very interesting and looked like there was a significant effect in region specific. So, if we can find matching neurocognitive data for those findings, I think it'd be a very strong paper.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it was interesting that the controls looked very much like what we saw in the Ping sample in terms of the regional effects. And the FAS kids were different. I mean, I guess the question is, why and what? How can we figure it out? But I think it would be really exciting to add some neurocognitive data as well. And one other thing is that I think we could increase the sample size if we had SES measures from Claire. So I will ask her if she's got that and it just didn't get entered or what. It's exciting stuff.
As an add-on, we've been working with all the sites to get the SES data in there, and it's possible that she's either in the process. Julie would be the one who's working on it, but we'll keep working on that to get the data.
Great.
So, again, it's like writing grants, putting symposia together sort of stimulates thinking, and there were a lot of great contributions to this. And hopefully we'll be able to see some papers come out of it also. Regarding the ISBRA meeting, ISBRA extended its deadline until January 15th. That gives us a little bit of time, but again, in the process of preparing this, Rajesh, Miranda, working with Tina and her group, has some very interesting microRNA data that, is there anyone from that group on? Because I can just say what you said, but if not, they appear to have markers of not just pregnancy with certain patterns of microRNAs, but also in the kids who have been exposed to alcohol, they have microRNAs that appear to differentiate those who are affected from those who are not affected, which would be very exciting. And they're going to have time. They thought it might take just a couple more weeks to increase the numbers. Their data were based on something like 30 patients and controls. So when they expand those, if those hold up, it would be not only a marker of exposure, but also a marker of effect. That's going to be the theme of the submission that we have to ISBRA. We have targeted that presentation, also Deepak, and the work he has on epigenetic marks. And then Kirstie Donald and Julie Cable are going to be presenting Kirstie on her work. And Kirstie, I see you're on. Do you want to just say in a nutshell what you're going to talk about?
Yes, hello. Basically, we've got data on quite a reasonably big group of neonatal kids exposed or infants exposed to alcohol in pregnancy and a control group, and so we're looking at structural DCI, resting state, and functional aspects of MRS aspects of alcohol effect in that group, and we have, in fact, we have published all of it, and so it'll be pulling that together in a coherent way, hopefully.
That's great, and Julie Cable is going to be presenting her work on the cardiac orienting response in children as young as 6 months as a marker or predictor of problems later on. And, you know, the general theme to this is going to be looking for early signs of both exposure and effect, either biomarkers or some of these early structural brain, functional brain, and cardiac physiological responses. So I think we're going to end up allowing people to have a little extra time to put it together and then put it together towards the end of the month for submission in January. And any questions about the symposia?
Michael, this is Bill Barnett. For the data sharing one, we're going into the FASD study group component of RSA. And do we need to submit our session separately?
It's already been, Jeff is on. Jeff, maybe you can speak to how this should work.
Yeah, we're just going to squeeze it into the agenda. I've already talked to the other officers about it. It will probably be about 20 minutes, although depending on how the schedule works out, that could grow or shrink by 5 minutes, and it's probably going to be in the morning. So we will just set aside a time. It's already on the program for the day, so you don't actually have to submit anything.
Okay, but we will for ISBRA.
I'm sorry?
But we will for ISBRA.
No, so we're not going to do it for ISBRA just because, you know, in looking at who will be at FASDG study group and who goes to ISBRA, there won't be many people at ISBRA who won't have been at the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder study group.
Okay.
So I would focus on just one substantive presentation. As I said, this is the Saturday of the start, just before the start of RSA, and the group that attends this really comprises anybody who would be interested in accessing these data. It's the best audience, I think, that we could come up with, and probably better than a symposium.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. So, Cassie, are you on?
Scott and I are here, and Scott's going to do the presentation.
Wonderful.
Are you ready?
We are ready.
Okay.
And eager.
Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Okay, good. Everybody can see my drugs here.
So yes, we can see your drugs.
So we're going to talk a little bit about our cannabinoid work. Some of you have seen some of this, and we're going to go into the cannabinoid and ethanol co-exposure that Michael just talked about, because it's really exciting. But just to bring everyone up to speed, I'll go over the cannabinoid exposure alone to bring everyone up to speed in case you haven't seen it before. This has been a little bit of a side project for us, but it has turned into something really interesting because the marijuana has long been suspected to be teratogenic, but it's been a bit controversial. And really the reason for that, I think, is that most of the studies done looking at whether or not marijuana was teratogenic was done back in the 60s and 70s. And over the course of the last 40 years, the levels of THC in your typical marijuana have increased nearly 25%.
It's kind of hard to hear you.
Starting to fade. If you get closer to your microphone, that would be great.
I'm sorry, say that again?
You were starting to fade, if you could keep close to your microphone.
How about this?
Very good.
Okay, good. So, and there are a couple of recent reports showing that, maybe marijuana is actually teratogenic. But maybe more importantly than that, there's been this increase in these potent synthetically derived cannabinoids, which have really only been used in the last 10 years, so we don't know very much about them, but it has become, especially among young people, the second most widely abused illicit drug in the United States and in various other places around the world. And what makes this particularly interesting is that these cannabinoids, both marijuana and these synthetic cannabinoids, are very commonly used with alcohol. And second only to alcohol and cigarettes, the cannabinoids, both varieties, are widely used by women of reproductive age. So it makes this a ripe area of research, particularly given that there's really no evidence no one has ever looked to see if these synthetic cannabinoids are teratogenic or not. And this has piqued our interest recently, particularly with the recent finding that the endogenous cannabinoids can directly inhibit the sonic hedgehog pathway. And as most of you know, we've talked about it a number of times, the sonic hedgehog pathway is absolutely critical for very early development. So we just resubmitted this paper. Hopefully it will be accepted soon. It was looking at the dose-dependent teratogenicity of one synthetic cannabinoid in mice. If we submitted it to neurotoxicology and teratology, they call for a special issue on developmental exposures to cannabinoids, so it was timely for us. But just for those who haven't seen it, I will go over a little bit of what we did. So we started with CP55940, which is one of the most widely researched synthetic cannabinoids. It is like THC, it binds to both the CB1 and CB2 receptors. However, unlike THC, which is a partial agonist, CP55940 is a full agonist and has a binding affinity more than 50 times greater than THC. So you can understand why these synthetic cannabinoids are so much more potent than marijuana and why so many more people are ending up in the ER after abusing these spice preparations. Like I said, it's one of the most well-characterized compounds in basic cannabinoid research. And the way that the cannabinoid research community evaluates any cannabinoid, whether it's an endocannabinoid, a synthetic cannabinoid, marijuana, etc., they use this tetrad of cannabinoid-induced behaviors, which consist of hyperlocomotion, antinociception, decrease in rectal temperature, and catalepsy. And basically, if you get this tetrad of behaviors, you basically are activating the cannabinoid receptors, particularly CB1. So we tested a variety of dosages ranging from 0.0625 up to 2 milligrams per kilogram. And these lower doses are what we think are clinically relevant for humans. The 2 milligram is probably a little high, but So, as we began this, we first wanted to know where these cannabinoid receptors are being expressed. So here is a classic picture from Cassie of a GD8 embryo. And this is a SEM. And this is a section right about through the middle of that embryo, stained for the CB1 receptors. And you can see this brown staining is in a very segmental pattern throughout the neuroepithelium of the embryo. So you can see that the CB1 receptors are present, which is something that no one has ever shown before. And we don't really know what the role of the receptors are, but they may be playing a role in neuromere development and segmentation of the early embryo. Perhaps we're still exploring that. So in this initial paper, we gave a variety of doses, like I said, ranging from 0.065, a fairly low dose, to 0.125 to 0.25. These are the doses that are typically used in most animal pharmacology studies, and then went up to 2 milligrams. As you can see, we tested a lot of litters, and the cannabinoid exposure doesn't really seem to affect litter sizes. They're all about the same. We don't seem to be killing any of the embryos. Weights are roughly the same, about 0.8 grams across the board. Crown to rump length, it doesn't seem to change crown to rump length at all, but it does induce a variety of craniofacial malformations, usually along the holoprosencephaly spectrum. And you can see some of these craniofacial abnormalities, like this upper midline deficiency, full exencephaly, micronathia, you see how narrow the skull is, and holoprosencephaly, and of course, completely missing eyes. When we look at the brains of some of these guys, here's a normal brain here. You can see the anterior commissure, septal region, striatum, cortex. You can see that the ventricles extend across the midline, much as you would in holoprosencephaly. So we're clearly inducing some holoprosencephaly-like effects. When we look at the brain in higher magnification, here we see the nice cortex of an animal. Here it is of a control animal at a higher magnification. But in some of our cannabinoid-exposed animals, we're getting cortical dysplasia here. You can see how abnormal it is. Here it is, higher magnification. So we're clearly getting some abnormal neuronal migration pattern.
Hey, Scott, at what doses did you begin to see the cortical abnormalities? You showed the 2 mgs, which is the highest.
Right.
How far down did you go that you were seeing this?
We're still looking at that.
Okay.
Just because you appreciate how much it takes to look at the brains of these guys, but we're still looking at that. What we did do as an initial study was look at the eyes, because that's something that's much quicker. And we know at this point the eye and the brain are developing together. So the eyes make a nice, quick, high-throughput read, and we can do a lot more doses, a lot more animals. And naturally, in our C57 mice, we get a spontaneous rate of eye defects. And here, this is a normal eye up here, and here we get a range of defects ranging from mild to a coloboma to completely anophthalmic. And in a few of our embryos, we do get some spontaneous eye defects. But when we give even the lowest dose of the CP drug, we get a significantly higher rate of eye defects. And of course, this goes up in a very nice dose-dependent manner, up to the 2 milligrams per kilogram, which affects most of them, 80% of them, roughly. So it's a very nice, clear dose-dependent effect. Say that these in here are all that within the realm of the function.
So Scott, just a quick question, which is, did you try doses lower than 0.0625? Because it looks like there's a fairly steep rise even at that lower dose.
We have. Now for this paper, we stopped at 0.0625 because we had to get the paper submitted by the special issue deadline. We have, and I'll go over that in just a second. So this is the paper that we hope will be accepted, should be accepted soon. The reviewers only had a couple of minor comments. But the real reason for doing all of this was not just because we're interested in cannabinoids, were interested in alcohol. So what we're doing now is, and this is what we'll present at the RSA symposium, some of what we'll present, is we're going to look at the co-exposure of ethanol and CP55940. And we started out with this 0.25 milligrams per kilogram. And we started there because it's a nice moderate dose. You get 50% abnormal eyes. So when we give ethanol, if we see an effect up or down, it'll be nice and clear. And then we started off with 2 ethanol doses, our normal 2.8 grams per kilogram, which gives us a high BAC of about 400 milligrams per deciliter. And then we used a half dose of 1.4, which gives us BACs in about the 150 range. And again, this is exposure on an acute exposure on gestation day 8. And this is a little bit different. This graph is a little bit different. These is percent abnormal eyes, but it's relative to control. So it's above the control level. And, you know, as Kathy has shown for a long time, you get about a 30% increase in eye defects with an acute ethanol exposure. And of course, at the 0.25 level, we get about 34% increase above control. However, when we combine ethanol and CP together, it shoots up to 82%. So this line right here is what would be the additive line if we added these two together. So we're getting a 20 to 25% increase over additive effect, suggesting that ethanol and CP must be acting synergistically in some way. When we did the lower dose, a half dose of ethanol, you get no eye defects. You don't get many eye defects above control. This isn't significant. You get the 34%, like I've shown you already. But when you add them together, you go almost up to 50%. Again, a 20% increase over what would be an expected additive effect. So we're testing a low dose. We're going down to a dose that is a tenth of this, 0.025 milligrams per kilogram. And at the moment, we're still preliminary. These data are still preliminary, so I'm not showing them. The 0.025 dose seems to be like this low dose of ethanol. It doesn't seem to be teratogenic, at least in terms of increasing eye defects. But when we give them together, we see eye defects at probably 18 to 20% above control levels. So basically, we're taking a dose of ethanol that is maybe subteratogenic or just fairly teratogenic, again, with 0.025 dose of the CP that doesn't appear to be teratogenic, and we mix them together and we get 20% eye defects. So clearly there's a synergistic mechanism there. And like I said, these are data that will be presented at RSA if the symposium is accepted. And along with that, we also have experiments looking in vitro to see if these synthetic cannabinoids are inhibiting hedgehog pathway activation. And we also have other mechanistic experiments that are ongoing where we're trying to see if we can reverse some of these effects by giving the cannabinoid receptor antagonist. And again, that data is preliminary too, but it looks promising. So maybe, anyway, this will tell us whether we're inhibiting the sonic hedgehog pathway, whether it's a receptor-mediated mechanism. We'll start to parse those out. That's it. Any questions?
I got a few, Scott. This is Dan. One, what's the vehicle you're using for the cannabinoids, and that is an IP injection you're giving, like the alcohol?
That's right. It is an IP injection.
So
these cannabinoids, as I'm sure you know, are really lipophilic. So
yeah.
We have to dissolve it in a small amount of ethanol and then further dissolve it in alcohol, which is an oil solution. And so we do get we are giving them a small amount of alcohol. It amounts to...
Okay. So the question was on the bar graph where you showed the first dose response, you did have a... you're going to back up for me? Good, thanks. Not that one, two or three back. One more,
oh,
I think.
This one?
Yeah. Your vehicle one there, you had like 1 in 7 fetuses with the vehicle had ocular defects. How does that compare with just basic control development?
So we... Over the years, I've done a couple of controls. If you do nothing to the dams, you don't handle them, you don't mess with their diets, you don't do anything, you get a spontaneous incident in the 5 to 10% range.
Okay.
So if you treat them with just saline, just a nice injection of saline, it does go up a little bit to 10 to 15%, depending on.
Okay. Because with this vehicle, it looks like it's about 1/7 of the...
Right. It is.
That would be about 14%.
And it's typically what we see with just injection
saline. All right. The second question is, because it's good that you're going to do the antagonist to see to what extent you can block this, do you know yet which of these doses would likely saturate the cannabinoid receptors? Because the point would be is that if at some of these highest doses that you are beyond saturating the receptors, then you may also be looking at nonspecific effects that wouldn't necessarily be reversed by the antagonist. So. In terms of selecting your doses here, I just wondered if you had information about that question yet.
So, just for the first part, I think that saturation probably occurs about the 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. Don't quote me on that. I'm going off the top of my head here.
Yeah.
So we are definitely getting a saturation at these higher doses. As to the non-specific effects, I absolutely agree that it could very well be a non-cannabinoid receptor mediated event. Like I said, the endocannabinoids, the endogenous cannabinoids, have been shown to inhibit sonic hedgehog, and we're looking to see if the synthetics do. But there are also other non-cannabinoid receptors, the TRIP receptors, that could also be involved. Unfortunately, no one really knows the expression pattern of any of the cannabinoid system this early in development. Nobody has looked at it.
So just to follow on to that question, looking at this graph, you would almost see an inflection point when you get between 0.25 and 0.5. It looks like something is saturating between 0.0625 mm-hmm. and 0.25, and then it rises again, and you wonder whether what you're seeing as you get to 0.5 is the beginning of effects of the receptors.
Yeah, you're right. It might be.
You don't have enough points to make that, and it's probably a happenstance, but but it's sort of interesting that it looks like it becomes asymptotic at 0.25, and then it becomes linear at 0.5.
Does. And you know, we may be looking at two different mechanisms, a different mechanism at these lower doses versus another mechanism, an additional mechanism at the higher doses.
Scott, I had a question. It's Joanne. Have you measured levels of endogenous endocannabinoids in these embryos? Because you have receptors expressing at a very early stage. Wondering how your synthetic adds to whatever endogenous levels are there, and maybe changes something in terms of maybe you're suppressing now the endogenous system by adding exogenous.
So we have not looked at the endogenous. We know that the endocannabinoid system is active. Other people have indirectly shown that the enzymes necessary to make the endogenous cannabinoids are there, but we don't know how much of the endocannabinoids are there. We don't know, and we certainly don't know what they're doing. But that is something that we are hoping to do.
I mean, it's a great point because the way a lot of these systems work is that there are pulsed releases of growth factors and neurotransmitters that are growth factors at that stage that have a need for spatial and temporal specificity to produce their effects. And what may happen is that when you have exposure to an exogenous cannabinoid, that you lose all of that spatial and temporal specificity, and you just, either are always on, or as Joanne, you just suggested, that you either desensitize the receptor or change, if there are feedback mechanisms, endogenous synthesis and release. So there are lots of ways that this could be problematic for a system that depends on finely choreographed activation of receptors over discrete periods of time and in discrete places.
Right. I mean, there's certainly evidence later in life, once the HPA axis is functional, that the endogenous cannabinoids are helpful in kind of dampening the stress response. And there's some positive effects of the endogenous endocannabinoids. But this is very early. The HPA axis would not be functional yet.
Nope.
I don't even know if the adrenal is really formed even at this point. The brain is at a very early stage, so it's not really applicable here, but later on, but the endogenous endocannabinoids may have some positive role in early development and then have other roles later as the brain matures.
Absolutely. In, for example, a lot of research has been done on the endocannabinoid system and implantation, because you need the cannabinoid receptor, you need the cannabinoid system, at least, for implantation. But nobody has looked at this time point.
And there's, in addition to that, Scott, I dimly recall a paper where there's cannabinoid 1 receptors in the placenta that facilitate the transport of substances, including serotonin, into the fetal circulation. And but I don't recall the date during gestation when those studies were done. It may be later than what you're doing here. But the point is that in addition to the direct actions they may have in the brain and other, you know, excitable tissues there, they could also be indirectly affecting things by actions that may be having in the placenta.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I just want to state what we've already said when we saw this the first time, which is this is very important and very exciting for all the reasons that you emphasized, and that is that co-administration of these drugs, especially in young women who is very common, and there's just not enough known about it. It speaks to the issue of thresholds. It speaks to the issue of what some of mitigating or facilitating factors might be for the development of FASD. And I guess a question I would ask all those people who are collecting human data is, do we have data on use of cannabinoids in our populations, and is it possible to look at that data in light of what Scott has learned, Scott and Kathy's group, to see if there is an effect that's discernible? Facial morphology might be a way to look at this, or brain morphology or behavior, but do we have those data?
The human databases do have questions about cannabinoid use, but as with our other data, it won't be highly detailed, and it is also dependent on what the sites have and have entered into the database. But the general answer is yes, data are available.
Yeah, we do. We definitely ask we ask, but we don't usually have the bio moms there to tell us.
And Leah, do we have anything for the face?
You mean from the genes that you wanted me to look at?
No. Do we have in the database of facial morphology information about cannabinoid usage?
Sarah would know that more than me. I think there is some very minimal information. I remember pulling it for Deepak.
Yeah, so the 3D face and the brain and the neuropsych data all use the same database in terms of exposure. So as long as it's been entered and it was available, we have the information.
I think I recall from a couple of calls ago.
This is Kirsty.
Excuse me.
Sorry, now I'll...
Go ahead, Kirsty.
I was just going to say that in our birth cohort, we've got questionnaire data, antenatally and biological urine data on marijuana in this particular group. But we don't have good images. We don't necessarily have many of those babies imaged, but you know, we still have the cohort going, so it's maybe something to look at as we go forward.
So the reason I ask, again, just along the themes of cross-modal kinds of papers, I don't know, you know, how strong the story will be. It sounds like as you finish this work, and especially looking at potential mechanisms with Sonic Hedgehog, if we really did have a measurable effect
that showed synergy in a human population, it would jump you up a notch in journals that would be looking at your papers. And, you know, since this is going to be the first synergy paper with alcohol and cannabinoids, it might be interesting if you could add to it CFAS data that shows that not only does this happen in a mouse model, not only do you have a putative mechanism if Sonic Hedgehog pulls up, but this also happens in a human population. You know, if you put that all together, one article, you could aim very high.
So, Ms. Cathy, a couple of phone calls ago, I vaguely remember someone from the South Africa representation saying that their population of mothers readily admit to using alcohol, but they don't readily admit to using cannabinoids, but in fact a lot of them do. Does anybody else remember that comment?
I do.
So we're talking about methamphetamine.
I thought that was methamphetamine.
I think it is methamphetamine, but the marijuana, basically any of the other drugs, are much less acceptable. But the good thing about marijuana is that because it's so lipophilic, it actually stays in the urine. For most of the other drugs wash out quite quickly, but marijuana stays in the urine for some weeks after use. So the biological specimens are actually a very good measure of whether it's being used or not, and we've got that antenatal data on the mammal.
Michael, I would appreciate it if anyone could come up with any human data showing this. I submitted this as an R01 in response to a NIDA program announcement, and it came back with the major criticism of none of this work was relevant, even though we're showing, you know, clinically relevant doses. But none of it's relevant because no one has ever shown that these synthetic cannabinoids are teratogenic, which is in people. Which, even though these haven't been around all that long, I would appreciate some clinical data.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd say two things about that comment. I'll say it calmly. The first, we don't require human teratogenic data to identify a substance as teratogenic. Bacteria used to be fine. Remember the Ames test. And secondly, that's all I can say. Human data is always great. So, you know, is there somebody who could just look quickly? I know that there's no such thing, but is there somebody who could look to see if there's any effect, even though the questions may not be so detailed? It just would be a very powerful addendum to this paper, and I really think that, you know, if you had human data that were good, that this is a paper that you could publish in Science or Nature or Nature Medicine or one of those places, just because it would be a whole story. And it has such, it's so topical.
This is Sarah. Maybe Scott and anyone else who's interested, you know, we could have a follow-up call to see. I'm happy to look at the database to see what data in terms of exposure data are available, but maybe we could have a separate call to talk about what dependent variables we would want to be looking at in the human data, and I'd be happy to organize that.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to work on that as well.
So, Jill, if I could ask you to help coordinate a call, and Sarah and Elizabeth, you can suggest others who might be on the call just to assist with data analysis, and with Scott and Kathy, and see if we can get it soon. Because Scott, when is your renewal due?
I'm still deciding. So the first grant was cannabinoid alone, and we've decided that NIDA doesn't believe in this, so we were going to do the alcohol and cannabinoid together. And I don't know, next next year. We were going to do, so I'm not going to do the renewal. I'm going to rewrite it and send it to NIAAA.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that I would think it would be well received in at NIAAA. I mean, totally speaking out of turn probably, but it seems like something that would be of interest, the combination of alcohol and cannabinoids.
Yep.
Well, George certainly made that clear when he visited us last year.
Yeah. So, I mean,
the other thing I'm wondering is if in the past data, if there, you know, would be any way to see if there's something there, but, you know.
Elizabeth, this is Peter. The past data is showing eye effects in mothers who smoke a lot before they conceive and also during pregnancy. So the question is, how do you distinguish between tobacco effects, smoking effects, and smoking cannabinoids?
I don't know, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, you obviously need to have people who did one, both, or all three, and
it seems like that makes the animal data critical because you can separate them. I mean, that's
yeah.
The whole idea.
It is, anyway. You know, Scott, just out of curiosity, have you thrown nicotine into the mess?
I have not.
Well, you know, I mean, these are the big three.
Yeah, but that's a hell of an experiment to design that for preclinical stuff.
Right,
yeah.
I wouldn't go there, but no. Someone may ask.
These mothers we've looked at are didn't admit to any drinking at all during pregnancy. So it is smoking alone.
Yes. I guess the point I'm making, Peter, is that if cannabinoids synergistically increase birth defects caused by alcohol, would cannabinoids plus nicotine have an even greater effect given some of the effects of smoking on the placenta and some of the more specific effects on nicotinic receptors in the developing brain? And again, there may not be a clean enough database to be able to answer that question in humans, but I guess we have a plan for how to ask this question. It would be great as a CFAS paper if we could combine human and animal data. It would certainly make a stronger paper, and it would be helpful to Scott if there were positive findings to show clinical relevance as he tries to get his R01 funded. So this is really exciting. Thanks so much for presenting it. We have a few minutes left. Jill, can you update us on where things stand for our meeting?
Our meeting is definitely going to be in Austin, Texas.
Can you get
You're hard to hear, Jill.
No.
Yeah, I'm having some phone issues. Is that better, worse?
Yes, much better.
Much better? Okay. I unplugged it once, too, so sorry if there was a recording of being continuing message, but my little prong thing broke. Anyway, the meeting is going to be Monday. Our travel day will be Monday, March 7th, and then a full-day meeting will be on Tuesday, March 8th, and that's going to be at a building on campus. The building on-campus room is not available for Wednesday, so I think we might meet in the hotel on Wednesday, which might work out okay because then you guys can just grab your luggage and go. Does that seem okay for you guys to meet in the hotel on Wednesday?
Sure.
Okay, all right. I'm just working on the cost. That's my only thing. It appears that all the language of the muffin rule has caught up with the hotels, and they're figuring out ways to charge us more. So I'm working on it, but I'll have the details for sure. But I think we'll probably wrap up around 3 o'clock on Wednesday as well. So as you start to kind of look at flights, I don't know when the advisory committee is going to meet yet. So those of you that are involved in that might want to hold off on your airfare for right now because it's possible we might ask you to stay Wednesday night to meet after the meeting wraps up. So I'll get that information as soon as I can. The airport is about 30 minutes from campus. And the hotel is right in campus itself. Does that seem right, Johan? It's kind of the AT&T Center is right there in the heart of campus, sort of?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, and then the building that we have the meeting space for on Tuesdays at the Student Union, and that's, they said it's less than a 2-block walk. Does that seem right?
Yeah, it's right there.
From between the two? Okay, and then it's across from a place where you guys can grab coffee, lunch. I forget what it's called. Is it the Drag?
The Drag, yeah.
All right, so it's right across from the Drag. So I'm keeping you guys hip on Tuesday, and we'll figure it out for Wednesday. But everything's coming together. I think Dr. Riley had mentioned to me the last time that the focus of the meeting is definitely going to be on kind of building these connections, which Dr. Charnas has been talking about today, between the different projects and making sure those publications get ready, and then focusing on the renewal. So I'll send another email, but if you guys can just take a look again at your hotel requests, I need to get those numbers finalized by the middle part of December here. So I'll resend the link that I put together, and if you can just confirm that those dates look good, knowing that there might be some changes based on when the advisory committee meets. Does that help everyone? Any other questions about it?
Jill, I had a question. Do we just
sure.
book airfare as we wish, or do we have to book through a specific agency?
Your airfare is on your own, so all of the projects, you'll pay for your travel off of your own grants.
Okay.
I will take care of the hotel arrangements. You won't need to do anything for that. When you check in, you'll just use your credit card, and that's how you'll pay for it once you get there. But I'm covering it a different way on the upfront part.
Okay.
So I'll take care of your hotel arrangements, but the airfare is on your own.
Okay, good.
Okay. Any other questions? And then if anyone has any speakers that they know of in the UT Austin area that they think might be good for the group, go ahead and let me know, and we can start communicating with them to come and meet with us for a portion of that. I think that's it for that guy. Did we lose Dr. Charnas?
I'm sorry. I was.
Oh, that's okay.
Was talking away all muted. But Johan, you should think hard about people who are at UT Austin, who might be good speakers, just because they're in the area and there's not a lot of good people there.
Yeah, definitely.
So are we thinking about people, other people who are not at UT Austin, or
people who are not too far away? Would be great, but if there's somebody who really would help us transform our thinking, we would certainly fly them in. So all suggestions are appreciated. Send them to Jill. We'll collect them, and we'll see what's feasible.
That's perfect.
Good. Any other announcements, Jill?
I think that's it. Thank you so much for all of your hard work on the symposia, and I guess I should, at the beginning of the year, start collecting all of your current IRB and IACUC approvals. So I'll send out an email about that, just kind of wrapping up the year kinds of things.
All right. Any other comments from the CFAS group? If not, we'll talk to you in a month.
Have a good month.
Bye-bye.
Have a happy holidays, everyone.
Holidays.
Bye-bye. Happy holidays.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.